Welcome to episode 68 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting as always from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also known as a very snowy Ottawa, Canada. Before I go on, I just want to say that Canada is and will remain a free, independent, sovereign nation. If you haven't done so, hit that follow button either on your preferred podcast app or go to FeedSpot where you can get updates whenever your favorite podcasts have new episodes. And remember, you can get episodes of Beyond Barbarossa early and ad-free by supporting through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support that you want. This is episode 68. As regular listeners know, Beyond Barbarossa tells the story of the Eastern Front chronologically, 81 years after the events. So that brings us now to February and March 1944. Last episode described the German Army Group North's retreat from its three-year siege of Leningrad and the Red Army's advance behind them to the Narva River and Lake Peipus. And in the south, we heard about the Korsun pocket and the breakout of the Stemmermann group from an almost complete encirclement by the 1st and 2nd Ukrainian fronts of the Red Army. Just to clarify, a front is an army group, but I think it's a good time now to describe in a lot more detail what that means. In terms of numbers of members, a Red Army front was about the size of a German army. So, for example, the Red Army, like the 46th Red Army, was about the size of a German corps, which is a subunit of an army. Typically, two to three corps in most armies make up an army. So, in the Red Army, in the 1940s, a Red Army corps was the size of a German division, and so on. So, in February, the Stemmermann group escaped the encirclement at great cost, including 30,000 casualties and all their tanks, heavy equipment, and the commander of the group, Wilhelm Stemmermann, who was killed on the last day of the escape. And that was all covered in episode 67. So if you need a reminder, go back and listen to that, but not before you get to the end of this episode. Now, that narrow escape in February 1944 did not mean that the Wehrmacht could rest in Ukraine. No, the Red Army was on the move. It had been for over a year by that point, ever since Operation Uranus, which liberated Stalingrad and liquidated the German 6th Army in February of 1943. So, between February 1943 and February 1944, the Soviets had forced the Germans to retreat over 1,200 kilometers, or 750 miles, from the banks of the Volga and the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains, all the way to the Dnieper River, and even beyond it. For the Germans, 1943 had been a year of, let's call them strategic withdrawals, to be kind to the Germans. And I'm not often feeling kind toward Nazis. Anyway, in 1943, time after time, the German generals would recommend withdrawing their forces to prevent their destruction, back to defensible positions, or just to shorten their lines, as we saw in the Rzhev salient. But the problem was that whenever a German general or field marshal recommended this, and just logically, Hitler would always refuse permission, at least at first. Instead, he would order the Wehrmacht and all its divisions to hold the line, to not take one step back, kind of like Stalin had earlier. He felt that retreat would only lead to a loss. But the thing was that this would just result in the Wehrmacht in those positions to be reduced through attrition and therefore weakened until they had no choice but to retreat or face destruction. The idea of withdrawing, you know, the people in the field, on the ground, in place at the time, their intention behind withdrawing would be to find positions where their soldiers and their technologically advanced weaponry could hold off the Red Army to prevent an even further or greater advance. But this became a kind of a cycle. A general like Manstein would request permission to withdraw. Hitler would refuse. The Wehrmacht would be reduced by the numerically superior Red Army until they had to withdraw. And then Hitler would say, see, all you ever want to do is withdraw. I think this is a good point to quote from a book called The Reckoning, The Defeat of Army Group South 1944 by Prit Buttar. At this stage of operations, Hitler thought he had found a new means of bringing the enemy's advance to a standstill. Henceforth, places which had acquired a tactical significance as nodal points of road or rail traffic were to be declared fortresses. Each was allotted an ad hoc commander or Kampfkommandant, who was in honor bound to defend the locality in question and answered for it with his head. The armies in whose sectors Hitler had personally selected such fortresses were responsible for stocking them up at an early date and providing adequate garrisons. Hitler assumed that by blocking important roads or diverting Soviet forces, these places would serve to delay the advance. In fact, it was clear from the outset that they would achieve no such thing. The location of some of these fortresses was so unfavorable that their defense seemed hopeless from the outset. Despite all remonstrances, even these places had to be held at all costs. For example, Brody, a small town in eastern Galicia completely surrounded by woodland, was located in a valley without observation facilities. Dominated by a nearby plateau in Soviet hands, the town was under complete enemy observation and at the mercy of his artillery. At one point, the woods even reached up to the edge of the town. Because of the lack of space, there was not even a suitable area for 13 Corps to locate artillery emplacements in case of a siege. End quote. Even when the German generals got permission to withdraw strategically, the intention was to fall back to a more defensible position and thereby build a strong defense that the Red Army would not be able to penetrate. But that would require time. They'd have to pull back units and have enough lag time to build those trenches and anti-tank defenses and so on to hold off the Red Army. But the Red Army never gave them that time. The Red Army was hot on the Germans' heels. At this point, on the Eastern Front, the Germans just did not have the numbers of people or other resources to allow a strategic withdrawal. That means withdraw a portion of the frontline forces back to this supposedly defensible position and build the defenses, and then the rest of the front could withdraw to that very defense. No, the Red Army was always attacking so hard that any withdrawal of forces would cause an immediate collapse. This is part of the greater Soviet strategy called the Broad Front, and I'll get to that. Through 1943, the Germans tried withdrawing to a defensive position that they called the Wotan Line. This was a hypothetical eastern wall, in German the Ostwall, a line of defenses that stretched from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. In Ukraine, that line ran along the wide Dnieper River, which seemed a perfect place to build a redoubt or a defensive position. That's because along most of the Dnieper River, which is a very broad river, I must say, the western or right bank is higher than the other side. So it gives you a little bit of a rise on that western side. And the eastern side is pretty flat, stretching back to, well, it's the steppe. So flat all the way to China, basically. So that gives you a view, making it easier to defend. But even with those hypothetical or theoretical advantages, the Red Army was still able to cross the river in the autumn of 1943. And we've covered that in the last few episodes. So here we are in February 1944. Map 1 on the webpage for this episode shows where the front line was at this time. And you can find a link to the page in the show notes. That's where we are, which brings us to usually our regular feature, what else is happening in the war. But I'm going to make this section very brief because we're still in February 1944, and this section has been largely the same for the last two episodes. So just briefly, in February 1944, the Americans and the British were still fighting at Anzio, Italy, and making very little progress against the dug-in Germans. In Germany, the Allies continued their day and night bombing. And then on 15 February 1944, the Allies bombed the Benedictine Monastery in the Second Battle of Monte Cassino. They bombed this monastery because they believed the Germans were using it as an observation point. In the Pacific, the U.S. Marines landed in the Marshall Islands and were fighting to take control of them from the Japanese. In Burma, the so-called Chindits, formerly the Long Range Penetration Group, special ops units of the British and Indian armies, were conducting successful operations against the Japanese. But that's a whole podcast in itself. Now, back to the Eastern Front. The Battle of the Korsun Pocket and the escape of Gruppe Stümmermann was over by 17 February 1944, as described last episode. The next day, the 18th of February, shifts our attention north. The 2nd Baltic Front under General Markian Popov launched an offensive south of Lake Ilmen. Popov is an interesting character. Since the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, he had served in almost every part of the Eastern Front, starting off with the Leningrad Front in the summer of 1941, then becoming assistant commander of the Stalingrad Front, so he's transferred all the way to the south in 1942. In 1943, he commanded the Bryansk Front at the Battle of Kursk, and then was sent north again to the 2nd Baltic Front. So he's been involved in some pretty important Soviet wins and some pretty significant Soviet losses. On 18 February 1944, Popov's front pushed the German 16th Army from the city of Staria Russia, south of Lake Ilmen, to Novorzhev. This brought them more or less in line with the Narva offensive's drive to the edge of Lake Peipus, as described last episode. See map 2 on the webpage for this episode. Now we have to go back down south. Following the end of the Korsun Pocket, for which General Konev of the 2nd Ukrainian Front got most of the credit, ignoring the significant importance of Nikolai Vatutin's 1st Ukrainian Front. Anyway, Vatutin's next order for the 1st Ukrainian Front was to take that front south toward the towns of Proskurov and Chernovitsy in order to prepare the Red Army's next massive operation, cutting off the retreat route of the whole of Army Group South. Now, to understand this, we have to back up again just a little. As described last episode, the 1st and 2nd Ukrainian Fronts had encircled parts of the 3rd Panzer Corps near Korsun, Ukraine, which is south of the city of Cherkasy on the west bank of the Dnipro. You probably know the shape of the Dnipro River, how it flows through the middle of Ukraine, northwest to southeast, then making a major bend at Dnipro, heading almost directly south, and then another bend at Zaporizhia to the southwest and the Black Sea. In that great bend, in that encirclement, or sort of a backwards letter C, there were still significant German forces. They were, as you can see on the map, nearly surrounded. Even so, this is a huge area, and that gave the Nazis a lot of scope. And don't forget, they're still a powerful, lethal military. As described last episode, in 1944, Germany had 9 million men under arms. That's immense. On the other hand, that was the largest it would ever be. While numbers don't lie, they also don't tell the whole story. By 1944, the German army, or Heer, had lost more than 2 million dead and missing. And that does not count other military branches, nor civilians. Germany was fighting on two fronts, in Italy and on the Eastern Front in Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. And they were losing people, equipment, tanks, weapons, and everything else faster than they could produce them. Meanwhile, the Allies and the USSR were producing more and more weapons faster than they were being destroyed. At the same time, especially the USSR was recruiting more people. At this point, I always ask, why did the Germans keep fighting? The generals and the other leaders had known that the war in the East, at least, was lost. And they had known that for a long time by 1944. I think there are a number of reasons for that stubbornness. Fear of Hitler's wrath is one. Top generals who disagreed with Hitler or who objected to his orders got fired. Lower ranks just got shot. Then there's the fact that the Allies, both Western and Soviet, had already declared at Casablanca that they would accept nothing less than total surrender of the Nazi regime. No armistice, no peace, just surrender, unconditionally. And also, there was the fear of retribution. Retribution for the crimes they'd committed against humanity, against morality, against life itself. A retribution that they did not prevent. Spoiler alert, but you know how this ends. But after that, I need just to take a short break. While I'm away, hit that follow button and then come back in a minute. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian man, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941. Just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. It comes in three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War. The Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941, through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase a three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses. Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army. Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more on my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back to part two of this episode. Well, we're looking at the Dnipro Bend in February 1944. In early February, the 24th Panzer Division, the German 24th Panzer Division, that is, withdrew from its position in Nikopol on the Lower Dnipro. Take a look at the map on the webpage. So they withdrew there from there as the Red 4th Ukrainian Front moved inexorably west. The Panzer Division attempted to attack northward near where the Stemmermann Group was trapped to try to participate in the relief effort. But that attempt failed. So by the 22nd of February, the 4th Ukrainian Front reconquered the city of Kryvyi Rih, the birthplace of current Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It was then known in Russian as Kryvyi Rog. Also that day, that's 22nd February, the USSR presented peace conditions to the government of Finland, which was fighting what it called the continuation war in the Karelian Isthmus and in the far north. For more information on the Finnish war, go back to the three bonus episodes on the Winter War. One episode is still available for free, as are episodes 10 and 11 on Operation Arctic Fox. But do that after you finish this episode. After withdrawing from Nikopol, the 24th Panzer Division withdrew more than 100 kilometers or 60 miles farther west. This brought them more or less even in a north-south orientation with the rest of Army Group South. But the Soviets had anticipated this withdrawal, and the 1st Ukrainian Front was moving from positions north of the 24th Panzer Division to try to cut off their retreat. But then they ran into a major snag. A quote now from Evan Maudsley's excellent Thunder in the East, the Nazi-Soviet War, 1941 to 1945. As Vatutin was preparing this operation, he was mortally injured. His command convoy, with an escort of only 8 men, ran into a band of several hundred Ukrainian nationalist guerrillas in a village a few miles south of Rovno, or Rivne, on the evening of 29 February. Rovno region was a turbulent place, formerly part of Poland, and with a three-sided battle going on involving the newly arrived Soviet forces and Ukrainian and Polish partisans. After the incident, the Stavka ordered decisive measures against the so-called bands and a regime of robust security for commanders. End quote. These Ukrainian nationalist guerrillas were from UPA, or UPA, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army. This was the armed wing of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. Before the outbreak of the war, this group had advocated for Ukrainian independence and, as a result, had been brutally repressed by the communist regime. They had allowed themselves to be deceived by the Nazis and declared an independent Ukraine, only to have their leaders arrested and imprisoned. As the war progressed, they fought both the Nazis and the communists, as well as Polish partisans. For more information, you can listen to episodes 33 and 34 about the resistance to the Nazi occupation in Eastern Europe. And I am going to return to that very subject soon. Anyway, the upshot at this point is that UPA, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, mortally wounded Vatutin on 29th February 1944. He was evacuated to Kiev, but died in April. In response, the Soviet High Command, Stavka, ordered decisive action against what they called rebellious bands, which may mean the Banderisti, a reference to the UPA's nominative leader, Stepan Bandera, who was then in Sachsenhausen prison in Germany. Zhukov himself took command of the 1st Ukrainian Front, driving them to the banks of the southern Bug River. So the 1st and 2nd and all the Red Army forces in Ukraine are moving kind of in a southwesterly direction. They've already taken back the northwestern corner, or most of it, up to the old borders pre-1941. So now they're conquering the rest, the remaining section under German occupation, which is the southwestern, less than a quarter, fifth of the country. Following that, in early March 1944, the 2nd Ukrainian Front chased the Germans across 240 kilometers or 150 miles through southern Ukraine, across the southern Bug, then the Dniester and the Prut rivers. Now, this withdrawal by the Germans was not like Stalingrad, much to the disappointment of Stavka. It was not even like the encirclement at Korsun, or not quite. The Germans did suffer great losses, but the new 6th Army under Karl Adolf Hollitt managed to withdraw largely intact. They even tried to take a stand on the banks of the southern Bug River in March, but then had to fall back all the way to the pre-1940 border of Romania. Meanwhile, farther north, Zhukov was driving the 1st Ukrainian Front against the junction between German Army Group Center and South. By 4th March, the Red Army had opened a breach between these two groups 50 kilometers or 30 miles wide. Back to Prit Bitar in his book The Reckoning, The Defeat of Army Group South 1944. And he quotes from a report from a German panzer commander. It was 6:15. Up ahead, the 1st Panzer IV with its black-spaced armor skated along the frozen road in tight turns in order to be ready for departure. Our entire body shivered with the cold. The village around us echoed with the rumble of engines and the clatter of tracks. And then it all quickly went to hell. While we were still guided, the drivers and the difficult-to-handle tanks moved out along the road between the mud huts. Russian harassing fire suddenly fell on the village. A deep howl passed overhead. Somewhere amongst the huts, a cloud of smoke and flames arose, and then dispersed to be replaced by the next impact. Endemann set out with his command tank leading, followed by Kloskowski, the commander of the Panzer IV Company. The column roared out of the abandoned village across a small wooden bridge over a small gully at the northern edge. There was another short pause. A brief exchange over the headsets informed the crew of the attack objective. Minutes later, the slowly approaching dawn made it possible to see a little. Our armored monster set off from the edge of the village over the crusty dark plain. With every gear change, the engines set out meter-long flames from their exhausts, dazzling the eyes of those following. The Russian artillery fire fell right on our attacking ranks and moved forwards, with us at the same pace. The morning cold penetrated through all the cracks in the open commander's hatches, from where we tried to make out the ground over which we were attacking in our binoculars. In front of us, the light tanks formed a firing line. Over there, a tank drove into a ditch and became stuck. If only we could see at least something. Suddenly, huge artillery rounds landed amongst the tanks. The enemy had spotted us before we could make out their positions. The Russians blazed away at the German tank attack with all barrels, with all available calibers. The explosions hurled the torn earth high into the air, and shrapnel and lumps of earth crashed against the hull of the Tiger. It had grown generally lighter, and we could see further. Thankfully, we could now at least orientate ourselves and work out where the enemy was. Our light company was already heavily engaged. The roar of their guns was deafening. To our right, the massed Soviet infantry swarmed forward across the entire breadth of the front line before our very eyes. As far as we could see, there were brown spots moving forward. Thousands upon thousands. The German infantry, just a few drops in the sea, abandoned their positions when they saw this and ran back to save their lives. Flares climbed up, hissing and popping, amidst the clattering of countless machine guns. One bit of bad news followed another on the radio. End quote. So now we're going to zip up to the north. And just back a little bit. By the 1st of March, the Red Army controlled almost all of Estonia and was penetrating into Latvia. Through March, the Red Army drove the German Army Group South back, southwest of the banks of the Dniester River, the border between the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic and Romania. The Germans established another defensive line here, but that's a story for another episode. What the events of February 1944 show is the effectiveness of the Soviet broad front and deep operation strategies. The broad front idea is to attack everywhere along the front all the time. And we can see this happening as the Red Army was simultaneously attacking in the north, center, and many places along the south throughout February. By keeping the enemy engaged everywhere, they would not be able to tell where the Red Army's intention was, what their actual goal was, so they wouldn't know where to concentrate their defensive forces. And with this continuous, ubiquitous attack, the German lines would have to crack somewhere. That's when the deep operations idea comes into play. The idea with the deep operations, and I'm going to go into this more deeply, see what I did there? Anyway, in a future episode. The idea with the deep operations is to have the, you know, this attack on a broad area. Eventually, some part of it's going to break, and the lead forces will penetrate the enemy lines there. Then, that's quickly followed by reserve forces coming from behind to take over the lead and penetrate even farther into the enemy's operational areas and logistic areas where they stage their forces, where they organize their supplies. The Red Army, in this case, would take over these rear areas for supply and logistics, and then they could turn and encircle the enemy. We're going to see this thinking and this kind of operation in the next several episodes through 1944, all along the Eastern Front. But those descriptions will have to wait for further episodes. So come back in 2 weeks to find out just what the Red Army and the German Army Groups North, Center, and South do. Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Barbarossa, still the only podcast in English focusing on the Eastern Front of the Second World War. As always, I have put maps and historical photos on the webpage for this episode. There's a link in the episode notes in your podcast app, or you can just go to beyondbarbarossa.ca and click on the title for this episode. Clicking on the icon or the picture will also let you hear the episode in your web browser, if that's what you like. If you haven't yet, please hit that follow button in your podcatcher. And if you have a moment, please give the podcast a rating or a review. That really helps other history buffs find our podcast. You can get notifications of new episodes of Beyond Barbarossa and other history podcasts by subscribing for free to FeedSpot. Just type feedspot.com into your browser. You can get episodes of Beyond Barbarossa early and ad-free by subscribing on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose whatever level of support you like. I also want to thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me by email at scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca or message through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina i heroyam slava!